Okay. Today is the 1st of October, and I am in Cordova and I am interviewing Dave Janka. So, and this tape has to be changed every half hour, so
Okay.
I'll be looking to,
Watching that, yeah.
I'll be watching that one. So, tell me about your experience with the oil spill, Dave.
Well, in 1989, I was living outside Valdez. Stan Stevens, Valdez had an overnight camp facility and salmon bake out at Glacier Island, and that we had, my wife and I had been helping run the camp in the summers, and that particular winter we decided to try living alone remote through the winter. So we talked Stan into letting us caretake it for that winter. So we were actually it's about 10 miles due west of Bly Reef, so we were actually living right out there when it took place. Actually, that day, late afternoon, I was coming back from Valdez in a skiff with supplies, mail. I'd go into town once a month to do that, and so I was about 5 hours ahead of the tanker departing, going off Valdez Arm, and got back to the camp pretty late because of all the glacier ice. I had, even with the skiff that I had to slow down and work through, which is one of the things that the tanker had to, had changed its course to avoid some of the ice later on that evening. And then woke up to a nice peaceful morning and put on my headset for the radio to listen to public radio out of Valdez, and had a rude awakening of what had just taken place nearby. So we listened to the news very attentively that morning and had it
What was your first
packed
thought?
up the. Oh, it was a surprise because I knew, at that point there was a lot of information out about the quality of the welds on the tanker fleet, that the TAPS tankers that make up something, oh, what is it, 20% of the U.S. fleet at that time, and yet they accounted for 60% of the structural issues. So I had always figured something's going to happen because of that, but it's going to be a major crack or breakup out in the Gulf, something along those lines, and not something as so, idiotic
I
as
was
just a
just, that's
drunk
just the word I was
cat, a
thinking.
drunk skipper,
Idiotic is the
you
word I
know,
was thinking. So you guys packed up
So we
to.
packed up the skiff and headed out there to see what was going on, as my wife Annette and daughter Holly, who was about 4 then, and we saw a couple of boats anchored nearby toward Elamar and Tetitlik. Some people we knew from there were anchored, and we visited with them. They were ready to go to work. They had worked on a small spill within Port Valdez that winter, so they had experience with it, and they were just waiting. So we visited them for a while, and it was amazingly quiet out there. Helicopter coming and going, and when we tried to skiff a little closer toward Reef Island in the tanker area, there was a small Coast Guard boat there that shooed us away, and they were clueless about asking. When we were asking them about oil to the beaches, wildlife, things like that, they were pretty clueless. They were just kids patrolling a perimeter, and then we zipped around the backside of Reef Island real fast. The boat and the helicopter went around the other side, thought we were going to go to those beaches anyway, but we just went into a backside beach, had a picnic, and then I hiked up to the top of the island to look down on the tanker. And by the time we were done with our picnic, then the boat and the helicopter were gone, so then we could go explore the beaches and see if anything was happening. But everything was going south and west of the reef and not up toward Reef Island. And as the day wore on, we headed back to the camp, and early the next morning, on the radio, got a call from one of those people I knew on the boat from Elamar, who had then finally gotten hired on that evening and had worked all through the night and needed some help. So then,
And working in what capacity?
towing a boom. So then my wife Annette ran me out there in the Zodiac to join him and work with him. So we were hooked onto a boom, one end of a, it was a quarter mile, it was a impressive piece of equipment. It was a large diameter containment boom, quarter mile long. We were on one end of it, the other end was attached to the corner of a barge, another little fishing boat had another boom heading out the other direction, so it had a big V off this barge, and that barge had a tug that was controlling its direction and speed, and we were keeping tension on the booms, and they had oil recovery skimmers inside the base of it. So for a while, we were, you know, felt pretty good because we were actually doing something, but the kind of equipment would clog easily with sticks, and because there was a lot of ice in the area, icebergs had to be kept out of it. And then it wasn't too long that the generator that ran the air pump that kept the boom inflated started acting up. And that's when some mechanics from Alyeska came over, and they already knew what the problem was. And it was a bad fuel pump, and they've just never replaced it. So that was like the first sign of the complacency coming in, and coming, you know, around. You know, not only was this, you know, state not inspecting the equipment to make sure it was up to snuff, but then also the oil companies were, you know, just letting things go downhill and not keeping up the maintenance. So stayed out with on that boat for about 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. Including when the north wind blew. We weren't notified of the north wind, so we were stuck on this quarter mile of boom with a gale blowing, trying to keep it, not lose it, and get into the lee of Bligh Island to try to save it. And of course, we're doing all this work very cold because we didn't have the stove on because we were worried about, you know, any ignition from the fumes. There was a test burn of some of the oil in the middle of the night. All of a sudden, this flame comes shooting up off in the distance, and there was no notification of that. That was
something. Did that test burn happen in the middle of the night?
Yes, yeah, with no notification. So it's quite. There's a lot of anxiety when things like that happen. You're there, freezing, you know, because you don't have your heater on in your boat, and then all of a sudden, this test burn takes place. You're like, I didn't wait but about 2 seconds. I got on the radio and said, somebody tell me that's supposed to be happening. You know, it was. Yeah. And then.
And so, who do you call about that?
Well, the two boats on the boom and that barge and such. We just had a channel we were working on. Other people had other channels.
So you were. I mean, it's not like you were calling Alyeska about that. I mean,
it was just generally some of the other work boats, which okay. Some of them were Alyeska because they were the only ones responding at that point in those first few days.
Yeah.
And it was just generally. On that radio frequency to let them to ask. And, you know, so, you know, that whole frustration was building up pretty quickly, you know, between, you know, we're all on this other channel and very focused and busy on what we're doing and, you know, not listening to the weather forecasts, but you would have thought that somebody would have been watching that for you and notified, oh, there's a gale coming, let's break down and get undercover before that hits. Oh, we're going to have a test of a burn over here, little announcement, but... That sort of thing didn't happen. And then after that north wind blew for about a day, then we took off down to Night Island following where the oil had went, and still had that boom intact after working down there for, about a day or so. We were just beat. We hadn't had much sleep ourselves, and by this time other boats were showing up that could relieve us. So then we tucked into a bay on Night Island and then and got a few hours of sleep, and during that time is when we were on the west side of Night Island, where a large mat of oil had, with that north wind, had blown over there, but it was just sitting offshore for about a day or so. Then a localized west wind came up that night that we went in, and it just slammed that oil onto the west side of Night Island. So mm-hmm. The east side got it from the north wind blowing the oil down, and then it was another day or so later that this oil that had kind of come into the lee of Night Island then got blown in to that side, so that northern Night Island had gotten hit from both sides. So when we came out from our little break, was the first time I saw the oil beaches and such, and that boom we had been using had gotten all tangled up with that west wind with new boats that hadn't used it, and not sure who was organizing what, but they had 3 or 4 of these quarter mile booms in this huge tangle, so that we started working on trying to get them untangled and laying across 3 or 4 of them, oily booms with a knife on a broomstick, trying to cut the lines that are connecting them and getting them untangled. And some of those pumps were starting to die completely now, so we're trying to get them untangled so that we could move them into shallower water, so that once the boom itself started to deflate and sink, it would just hit the bottom, and the little boat that had the generator and stuff would stay floating And then later, we found out later, actually, a friend of mine was working as a mechanic. He came out later and actually fixed the one that we had gotten into some shallow water and kept from sinking and got it working again. And then it was about that time, then the Exxon people, you know, started showing up. And that's when they came on the boat. It was just their attitude, their arrogance, and the way they were describing how things were going to go. That just after these days of near-death experiences and frustrations, that was just enough for me. I had it, and I said, I'm not going to stay out here any longer.
And what did they say about how things were going to go?
Well, it didn't give me any confidence that they had. You know, I could see that it was going to turn into of course, that was our first news, as just as how big the spill was and where it went and what was going on. So that just the size of the response was overwhelming to me. You know, the Navy was coming in and things like that. Some of those things were just seemed overwhelming to me.
So that information was relayed to you via the Exxon.
Yeah, right. And then he was going, you know, a classic configuration you see still being practiced with boats and boom is, you know, a boat on each end and they've got this big semicircle and immediately goes, well, we know this doesn't work. This is just a waste of time. And yet there's boats all around us doing it. And, you know, because what happens is the oil builds up in the back of those booms and then it trains underneath and comes out the other side. Well, there's... You don't go as fast, you get a skimmer, and, you know, there's other ways of doing it. So it was just his, you know, coming in there and his way of presenting all of that was just, you know, without any, you know, feeling about what an event this was to to us who were, you know, locals living there. And, mm-hmm. and so then I just decided if I stayed out here, either I'm going to come close to killing somebody over some issue or somebody's going to... take issue with me in the same way. So I went back and went back to be closer to the family and to my previous job commitment at that overnight camp, and then spent the summer mostly just being able to pass along information, real information, to the visitors that were still coming through through there. And then later on, then even that I burned out with, because it was hard to get other help because everybody was wanting to work on the oil spill. And then it was also frustrating. Oh, should I have stayed out there and made more money, or should I have done this and be close to the family? And, you know, so that is very, very frustrating. So I finished out that summer, but then didn't work there.
Well, tell me some more of the drama of being so close to the Exxon Valdez in those first few days and being right there where all the oil was. I mean, just not very many people who can tell that story.
Yeah, no, it you just get carried along by it. It's just so surreal, you know, it's just so massive. There's, you know, obviously nothing you as an individual can really do about it right there. So you're just there hoping, you know, trying to figure out what you can do to help. But of course there's no plan, no organization to anything, so it was very frustrating.
Yeah.
And
could you see the writing on the wall as far as, I mean, with the knowledge that you have of how oil spills progress and the likelihood of fetching very much of a percentage of it, was this just obviously a catastrophe right off the bat, or was there...
Yeah, I wish in those first day or two I would have sat down and written out what I was thinking is going to happen, you know, mm-hmm. later that year, 5 years later, or 10 years later, and then now open it and read it. It would have been interesting, and I think it would have followed pretty close, you know, just knowing the nature of it all and seeing what was happening, you know, the initial part, seeing what was happening and such. That because I already from I came up and moved to Valdez, into Valdez for a visit in 1976, and then moved there in 1977, and lived there till 93 when we moved over here to Cordova. So right now it's 30 years in the Sound. So a lot more gray hairs than when I got here, that's for sure. But seeing other events that have happened in Prince William Sound and still see their changes still, the 1964 earthquake, or some of the smaller oil spills that took place during the 64 earthquake that you still find evidence of out there. And then this is such a larger magnitude with crude oil, you know, that's going to stay at least as long as that did, if not longer. So, you deny a lot of it too, right? Even though you're looking right at it, I mean, the whole thing follows as other people have looked at it and found this to be the case. It's very similar to losing a loved one, and you go through this denial and acceptance, and there's a whole series of levels of feelings you go through after something like that. It was very similar. And of course, being there right from the start, you're on a different time frame than other people who are coming into it later. I remember after I came back into town from being out there, a good friend of mine was having a birthday, and of course they'd been dealing with things in town as well for a week.
And when you say town?
In Valdez. That was in Valdez at the time. And we'd all been dealing with all this for a week plus, and there's all these new people coming in, you know, oil people, scientists, environmental folks, news people and things. And, well, we went out to celebrate her birthday and almost went over the edge of just being crazy silly with it all. And a lot of that was in that it's actually a normal response and a process of going through after some of the grief acceptance thing. But it was interesting to see some of these people just taken aback. How can you be doing this while this is going on? And it just showed that disconnect of, you know, we were on a different level, a different timeline than they were with it.
Different step of your grief reaction.
Right, yeah. Right. And even when my family and I went out that first time to go see what it was all looking like and happening, and then we went back to the camp, it was either that evening or I think it was the next morning, but before I went out to join that fellow on his boat, there was some sheet ice in the bay that, you know, for the winter had been frozen up, and there was a sea otter up on the edge of that ice, and it was just acting very strange. And we came up with every possibility of what was happening, except oiling. You know, we were still not real, you know, wanting to accept the fact that here we are 10 miles away, there's this oil spill there. And that this, you know, and then in retrospect now, you realize, yeah, it got a little bit of oil on it. It came as far away from that as it could and hauled out and was trying to clean itself. And it died during that night on the ice. And then by morning, it was just skin and bones from the eagles and birds coming in to pick it apart.
So tell me, in what way it was acting crazy?
Oh, it was just overly cleaning itself, you know,
frenzied.
Yeah, very frenzied. Mm-hmm. And then also when it would stop, sometimes it would have these twitchings and movements around its abdomen and such like that. So it's probably from ingesting, and as well as probably going hypothermic from its fur losing its eating capacity from the oil.
It was the same one, because when he went by it the next day, that was where it was.
Right. It was dead and mostly showing bones from the animals eating. So it was just, you know, there's this huge magnitude event taking place, and yet you're still, you know, we're still in that denial. Well, this couldn't be happening like this right here.
So when you saw the cadaver of that, sort of put things in a different perspective for you?
It did, yeah. And then once I got out there, you know, you wouldn't see, you know, it was very quiet, you know, there's not many wildlife around. The oil was just so thick on the water, and a lot of people would take them all left or whatever, but it would be the fact the oil was so thick, you might see the little just convex bump on the oil, and you could start realizing that's probably a bird, you know, but you could not even see it, you know, at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, those were probably the ones that, you know, you'd never would have seen to be able to recover to add to the body count.
They never got counted.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Such an awful thing.
And then after, then the following year, 1990 and 91, felt better about going out there, just because it was more organized. It wasn't the complete circus, war zone kind of atmosphere, and did go out with some local response projects, some relief skippering on some vessels, as well as...
And doing, what was your project then?
Well, with the relief skippering... there'd be small boat groups out there specifically assigned to different agencies. So for one period of time, it was helping run a boat that was just strictly at the Coast Guard's disposal to run around and look at the different work crews that were...
So people were cleaning the following summer.
In 2 more years, 90 and 91, they were still major cleanup in 90 and a little less in 91.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly the bioremediation
in
91.
So in what manner of cleaning were they doing cleaning in 90?
Pretty much everything except the larger hosing down and pressure spraying. They were really bringing in the bioremediation a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of beach berm relocation and tilling of mm-hmm. the soils.
So at that point... You said you felt better about the thing, so there wasn't as much... I mean, obviously, during the winter, a lot of the oil went out, but there was still a lot.
Well, it wasn't on the water, but it was all on the beaches now, so that was all directed toward...
And how long did it take before you could actually... I know that you can still dig down and get oil... today.
Right. Well, you don't have to dig too far either in some locations. In some places it still is on the surface. But the majority of the residual oil is subsurface oil mm-hmm. sediments.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some places that still you could just step on it if you didn't know you were there. And that's just starting, those areas are just really starting to harden up and really dry out. But there are still some that you could do with, you can get at it easily with a pocket knife or turning over a rock and still have it. It still looks like oil and smells like oil. And the tests they do on it, it's still oil and toxic. So.
Not that this isn't necessarily going to be in the story, and I want you to know you have control of that, because once I edit this down for length and before it goes into the book, I'll be sending you a copy of the text. If there's something that you needs correction,
mm-hmm.
or if you can think of a word that you had wished you had thought used at the time, you'll have an opportunity to do that. But I'm just curious about, I was living in Homer, had a couple of little kids at the time, and my husband and I didn't have anything to do with the fishing industry or anything, so it was just something we were monitoring. But now that I've gotten so involved in this project, it seems to me like there's a corollary between what's going on in our country right now in terms of the war and this whole thing, the oil spill, in the sense that you're hamstrung. You're just watching a situation that you can't do anything about. It's getting worse and worse. How could you ever, living here in the Sound, how could you ever get over it? Do you get over it?
I get out a lot out there, mostly, you know, I run a charter boat business, and we do custom overnight trips all over the Sound. A lot of it's related to agency research and work trips, and then a lot of it's natural history trips with tourists. And of course, it's just it ends up now being, you know, part of it, the history of right. Prince William Sound. So you're having to discuss it, but you're always having to let people know, or they will ask, was this area oiled, or where was the oil, or what is it like now? And I mean, if we're in that kind of an area, we'll certainly, some people are interested, and we'll stop and look at it. Tended with time to not directly bring it. No, I do, because I always have these little jars of samples I'd like to give to people to make them know, even though I could say, I show them on the map, you know, this is not where we're at, but this came from here, this is what it's like. And but more often than not, they'll ask. I enjoy the tourist trips a lot because they'll tend to not be in the oiled impacted areas. It's nice to walk on a beach and not be looking for oil to put into a jar. Mm. And yeah, I guess it's, you know, I mean it's hard to get away from it, whether it's you're in an area that was impacted by the oil, or if you're crossing the tanker lanes, even if there isn't a tanker around, you know you're crossing the tanker lanes from what's written on the chart. So it's all, or you're going to see an escort vessel, or there's the pre-positioned spill equipment that's placed in different locations in the Sound. You'll pass those bays and see that equipment. So it's, you know, whether it's the industry as well as tied in with the spill itself, it is something that is not really to... You can't really put it behind you, because the threat's there for it to happen again as well.
Right. Well, I guess another way of putting it, and once again, this is just for my own trying to cipher this thing out. At the time that it happened, of course, there was that big focus on Hazelwood and then the trial and making him be the bad guy and the whole thing, and now it's almost like he's almost irrelevant when you look at the whole picture. That people have come to that notion that the way that the system was so screwed up that, you know, it's like Ricky Ott said, it was not if but when. I don't know. I guess I don't even have a question beyond that. It just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
It just drives me crazy. That.
Well, you do. I mean, after the, it certainly assisted with the spin for the oil industry to actually focus on an individual, the captain, and pull attention away from some of the other things going on. Whether there were people down south who, it wasn't until years later that they even knew that the tanker had been in a maneuver to avoid ice coming out of Columbia Glacier, which had been an issue even before tankers started going. Was Columbia Glacier, and it's always on the verge of this catastrophic retreat that was going to put out a lot of ice and a lot of study related to it, but then most all the news reports that went out of state had dropped the ice issue, and everything was focused in on this, you know, the drunk captain scenario. And of course, then that also put aside, well, exactly how much oil was spilled. That, you know, got put aside. Some of the other problems going on too, and such could put, you know, to build that up as a more of an attention getter over time. And now, like you say, you know, Hazelwood as an individual, well, no, that wasn't the real problem. The problem was there was an oil company that allowed an individual like that, who didn't even have a driver's license because of drinking problems, to run their tanker. You know, that's the bigger issue than the skipper himself. And then now with, you know, in 91, I think it was 91, I was involved with one of the last of the big beach surveys where they walk every section of beach and they've got maps that show what the last oil geomorphologist mapped out earlier that year or the year before or whatever. And
what was the word you used?
Oil geomorphologist. It's just a geologist who's into oil on beaches.
Okay.
And that was almost like a consultant hire by the oil industry. So you'd have this whole little flock of people hitting all these six different groups were walking the beaches, and you'd have an Exxon rep, and you'd have a couple of VECO workers, and you'd have this oil geomorphologist. Then you'd have the Coast Guard, you'd have the upland landowner, which was quite often either the Forest Service or Native Corporation landowner. And you'd have a NOAA biologist out there and a DEC rep. So there'd be all these people wandering. And that particular survey, one of the last ones they did in that size, we the local response groups and local communities, got them to include a local representative on there too. So I was able to join one of those. And, you know, they'd go on these beaches, and of course, everybody except the DEC person and myself would be trying, we'd be wanting to start mapping out the subsurface oil, but none of them wanted anything. It was going to take too long, and that's not what they were there for. So Exxon already had even NOAA and the Coast Guard at the time to try to ignore that subsurface oil and only look at be mapping the surface. And the DEC person would really hold up the group. Because he wanted it, because the map showed it. You know, they showed, oh, here it is. We should make sure and double check here now, a year after this map was done, where this oil is. And we got to some of them, but just the sheer push of all these other people wanting to keep moving, couldn't do it all. But all these people would sign off on these beaches saying, okay, yeah, there's still oil here, but it's going to be gone in a few years. And to come back in and try to remove these patches of oil would not be cost effective, would do more disruption maybe than we really need, because this oil will just be gone in a few years. And everybody from top to bottom, that's what their impression was, that this is what's going to happen. And of course now we've learned that was the big thing that didn't happen. That was the unanticipated issue, the unanticipated damage, was that this oil was not going to go away in just a few years. And that it's still there and it's still toxic, and we've learned that it's more toxic than we thought it was before.
So your hunch was right. You should have gone back and removed it.
Yes. Yeah. Because then they allowed should have been an acute problem. You know, this incident takes place, you get all that oil out of there, and it's done. But by leaving that oil there, they've turned it into a chronic issue.
Yeah. And it's there. Well, I have to say, Dave, you've got a pretty good attitude about it.
Yeah, I often wonder why. I mean, some respects, I think if I had stayed out there, you know, after those first 5-6 days, and stayed out there when I talk to other people, they come back to many of these bays and coves and they cannot get the image out of their head of 500 people and these big barges with these big spraying arms and the oil 3 feet thick on the beach and things like, they cannot get that, they can't go to those beaches without thinking of it by its number, KN501, and with these hundreds of people and this thick oil there. And I think in some respects, maybe in the back of my mind, or maybe at the time in the front of my mind, I was thinking it's not going to be healthy for my long-term health of living, wanting to stay here, to see it that way.
Yeah.
And that might have been some of the decision processes of leaving it, you know, at least getting away from it after those first 5-6 days, and then coming back to it, you know, in future years where it's a little more organized and quite not as...
So... what you're saying is that bays and coves that always before were known by their names, once they were put on a grid, That's how people associate. I mean, even though the old names obviously still exist.
Right, or some of them might not even had names before, but right. You know, then there's also names that are given so many places that just still stick, like Death Marsh, yeah. Or Diesel Beach, or things like that. You know, there are those kinds of names that still sort of stick, and you can't get rid of them. But that's mostly because of the amount of oil that's still there, or the impacts of some of the chemicals they tried to use. The Diesel Beach one is just because of some of the other chemicals they tried to use as a test to wash it off. Smelled more and probably had more impact than the oil did. And then there's the thing, too, a lot of people that I have a hard time with is they say, well, you know, the cleanup, you know, had done damage, or sometimes say did more damage than harm than good, or something like that, although I have a hard time with that, because the thing that is the problem is we've left a toxic substance sitting on the beach out there that's continuing to contaminate food sources of animals and such. And the problem with the it's a cart before the horse. People are just not, and these are people who are going to make decisions in the next spill, are not seeing that it was a mismanagement of the cleanup that did any of these damages. You know, you needed to go in there and you needed to get this oil out of there somehow or another. And especially in that first year, nobody had a clue of what to do, so they were throwing everything at it. You had people managing crews that didn't know a high tide from a low tide, a biologically rich zone of the beach from a dead zone of the beach. Mm-hmm. So they would tend to start, they're on an 8-to-5 schedule with their crew. They're washing this oil to the water so that they can recover it. And after a week, you start getting into the new or full moon tides. The tides are getting bigger. And all of a sudden, instead of just working on this barren gravel rock area of the beach, all of a sudden these rich biological zones of the beach are being exposed. But they're continuing to work 8-to-5 and washing the oil down into those areas and into the water. Now, does that mean that cleanup did more damage and we shouldn't do it next time? No, it's just there was a mismanagement of the cleanup, and we just have to come in there with a better understanding of what we're doing and where we're doing it. And it's very hard. I mean, you hear even, you know, NOAA people talking about the spill in Spain recently. I said, well, we've learned from the Exxon Valdez that cleanup can do more harm than good. It was a mismanagement of the cleanup. And pretty much just in 89. But they're taking that and extrapolating that out to future spills. I think it's going to be a real, it's going to be real damaging in the future.
Good point. Yeah, because I've certainly heard that a number of times. But that's a fine distinction, and it needs to be put down on paper for people to think about it.
Yeah. Because you can, one of the local response projects I worked, Governor Cooper at the time got a lot of pressure from local communities because the Exxon, and then turned for safety, the Coast Guard, everybody else had such control over the areas impacted by the spill. It was very difficult for anybody to do anything unless you were hired by the oil company and be on their crews to work. So some money was made available to communities within the spill-impacted areas to put together local response plan projects. And then quite other Coast Guard and Exxon wouldn't allow them into the actual oiled areas when they were working. So it really restricted what could be done. A lot of it ended up being trash pickup. And there was a lot of spill-related trash that in and out of the spill zone areas. But we worked some out of Valdez, which that program was managed by the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance at the time. And we went back, this was in fall of 91, after all the cleanup was finished, but there were some areas near salmon streams that Fish and Game knew there were these patches of oil remaining, and they were in the immediate drainages of some salmon streams, and they were not comfortable with having these big VECO crews come out and do cleanup, because they're just too heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. But we worked out a setup with a small group of people with a little extra sensitivity training to the salmon streams, went in there pretty much with hand tools, and we'd find these patches of oil, and either if it was very heavily oiled, we'd remove the sediments completely, or we would just till it through a number of tides, and just surgically work some of these patches of these residual oils close to a salmon stream. So it really showed that you can go back in there and carefully finish off, because I've gone back, and unfortunately we didn't add any funding to that project for any follow-up to it, because we documented our work very well, but then we didn't follow up and go or have a control with it. But I've gone back to some areas, and I can't find oil in the sediments, and things are growing real nice on the surface, which when we were there was nothing on the surface. And another pocket beach a little farther down, which was farther away from the salmon stream and not really part of our focus, I could still find oil, and there's not anywhere near the variety or size of things growing on the surface. So anecdotally, you know, it works and can work for these patches of oil. And the thing with the oil that's remaining out there too, it strikes me, you know, they always talk about the expense of doing it, re-exposing the oil, etc. But you see regularly people are driven to bankruptcy over fuel tank contaminations at small mom-and-pop gas stations, or at homes where you have a fuel tank that's leaked into the sediments. You look at, and then you've seen these long houses or next to gas stations, these big piles of gravel under tarps that they've had to dig up and they're having to buy or remediate. Well, these people have had to rip up asphalt or pavement or concrete and pull up these tanks, pull out all this gravel, clean it, put it all back, resurface the area. And some people just, and these businesses cannot make it
right.
By doing that. The gas stations don't reopen. They're put into bankruptcy over these things. And yet, and many of these gas stations are nowhere near a clean water source. They're in the middle of a, you know, concrete and highway area that there's no clean water source anywhere around, and yet they're required and to do this. And yet here, out in Prince William Sound, this pristine, near pristine area, the richest company in the history of the world is allowed to leave these contaminated soils out there. It's something's not right with that one. So their excuse that, oh, it's too costly, it's, you know, to remove all these rocks and then clean the soils and put the rocks back, is just, how would we do that? And yet the government agencies require individual citizens to do that all the time and bankrupt them over it, and yet they're allowed to leave that leave the sound out there like that with 25,000 gallons of oil contaminating, I think, 15, 16 acres of beaches. I think that's the estimate.
Sounds like that's the story.
That's about a half hour, too. Maybe.
Yeah.